Hello, everybody, and welcome to the History Voyager. As always, there are a zillion podcasts out there. Thank you very, very, very much for listening to mine. Josh Ellis is a very interesting man with very interesting things that have happened in his life. He's very modest about it, but he literally was one of the founding fathers of the modern internet. He is back with a social media app that he is going to talk about in this episode. And I remember hearing, I'm of the age when I heard all the time that you people, meaning the professor, would say, you people lived through the most important communication revolution in the world. And, you know, I think I knew she was right or he was right, because they would all say it, the different professors. I think I knew they were right, but I don't think I knew how right they were. Our society has changed partly for the worse and partly for the better because of the internet. And that's something I'm going to get into a little bit later in different episodes. But I thought it would be interesting to talk to literally one of the men who created the internet that we have today. And he's got a brand new app, a social media app that's going to be different from Facebook and Twitter and TikTok. Anyway, so enjoy. Hi, everybody. This is Ben Kitchens with the History Voyager. I'm here with Josh Ellis. And he is a man of very interesting interest. And today we are going to talk about, I'm going to butcher this name, it's Kowloon. Okay. Why don't you tell the good people of the internet what Kowloon is?
Well, Kowloon is a piece of software I've been working on now for almost 5 years. It is a new social network that works a little bit differently than any of the current existing ones. It's free and open source. There's no data tracking. There's no ads. There's no data mining or anything like that. It's designed to do what people want social networks to do rather than what corporations want them to do.
I really hope it works out. Let me just put that out front right now. I really, really want this to work.
Me too. I think a lot of people really do right now. People are looking for better options than what they've got.
Yeah, I mean, my thing is, with TikTok, okay? My thing is with TikTok, in case it actually does get banned or go dark or whatever, TikTok is a video-based platform where you have these little short videos. I think they're up to 30 minutes, but who in the world can do a 30-minute video on TikTok? Sure, it brings people together and this and that, but it's also just infomercials, and also it might be propaganda from the Chinese government. It might not be. I don't know. I've seen arguments both ways. But it's very problematic. But maybe with this we can actually build community. So why don't you walk me through a hypothetical usage of Kowloon?
Okay, well, one of the things that makes it different from other social networks, not just the big commercial ones like Twitter X or Facebook or TikTok, there's already an existing set of sort of non-commercial or open source social networks like Mastodon, in theory, Blue Sky, although Blue Sky is actually owned by a corporation. But these networks make up what's called the Fediverse, which is basically a federation of social networks that can maybe kind of work together, maybe not, but they share similar philosophies. One of the things that's different in these models rather than in the sort of the big commercial model is that when you join up, you join a server. Most people who are on Blue Sky are, you know, they're my handle is at jzellis.bsky.social, you know, or mastodon.net or whatever. But in those models, in those networks, the server you're on doesn't really matter. They all go to the same place. So it's basically like, you know, who's your email provider? Is it Gmail? Is it Hotmail? It doesn't really matter. It's all just email. In Kowloon, each server is a standalone community. So, for example, if I create one, I can invite all of my friends to it, anybody I like. And even if nobody else in the world uses Kowloon except for me running this one server and my friends, it still has a couple of uses. You can do anything you can do in another social network. You can post things. You can create groups, you know, like Facebook groups, whatever you want, kind of subreddits, the equivalent. But what I think is interesting is about this is that every public post you make on a community in Kowloon is published to a web front end. If you go to my server and you're not a community member, but if you go to my community, all of those public posts will appear on the front page, like the Huffington Post or a site like Slashdot or Metafilter.
I'm trying to remember. I cannot remember the site because we're both elder Zennial or whatever.
Yeah,
I cannot remember the internet website. I don't even know if it's around anymore, but it was like, essentially, it was like the greatest hits of, you know, like you could have articles posted from all over the web on this one page, and the ones that got upvoted the most or whatever would be the top seven or eight that you'd see.
Well, I think you're thinking of Dig.
Yeah,
Dig with two G's.
Yes.
So when you post on a Kowloon community, you can make your posts visible to community members only. So they're like only visible to people who are logged in to the server, who are members of that server. Or you can make them public, and the ones that are public are displayed on the front page. But that's only one of the things I think that makes Kowloon kind of cool and interesting. Another thing about it that is different that I've never seen anybody else do is that it has different post types.
Talk about that.
Right now there's four types. There will probably end up being more. But the default type is just called a note, and that looks like a tweet or a toot or whatever they call it in Mastodon. 500 characters, just text, doesn't have an image or anything, you know, just a note. Then there's articles, and articles are longer. They can have a title, they can have tags, they can have a featured image, like a blog article, right? You've got links, and a link is just nothing but a link to another URL, or it's how you share posts in Kowloon instead of quoting them the way you do in Facebook or Twitter. You create a link to that post, but this can also have a title, your own commentary, a featured image, whatever you want.
Can you share outbound links yet? So an outbound link is like a hyperlink. I know you know this, but an outbound link is like a hyperlink to a separate website. Like on Twitter for a while, you couldn't share links to other
social media right. sites because
no, no, know. this is either this can be either a link to another Kowloon post on your own server or someone else's, or it can be a link to anything, a Wikipedia entry. Okay. And the fourth type is media, which might be split up into audio, video, and images. But basically, right now, if you post an image, a video, an audio clip, or a gallery of any or all of those, it creates a media post, which again can have a title, it can have a description, etc.
Okay.
So what's useful about this is that Kowloon doesn't have an algorithm. This is my theory. So I should preface this by saying I first got on my first online communities were dial-up bulletin boards in the late 1980s when I was a preteen.
Okay.
You know, I was one of those nerdy kids, and so, you know, I'm 11 years old, I'm 12 years old, it's 1989 or 1990, and I'm in the middle of the night, I'm dialing into a bulletin board in my area, because we still had long distance charges then. And, you know, these were the earliest versions of online communities. They weren't on the internet, technically. They were still, you know, dial-up only, but it was exactly like a bulletin board, a forum, a Reddit, whatever you want to call it. You could download files, which back then were basically text files and occasionally, you know, really low-res porn images or whatever.
Yeah.
And then, so in the 90s, like a lot of people, I was on MSN when that first started as an internet provider, similar to AOL.
I never knew. Well, did I know that? I don't remember, but okay.
Yeah, before there was MSNBC, MSN was Microsoft's version of AOL.
Get out of town. All right.
And my grandfather was a Microsoft beta tester. So
okay.
That's how I got onto the internet right out of high school. So I would dial up into MSN.
I just wanted to interrupt you for half a second to tell the world this. You are literally one of the founding fathers of the internet. And I'm not bragging on you. I'm just reporting a fact.
I wasn't so much a founding father. I was more like the guy in the room watching John Hancock and going, hey, maybe you want to use a bigger pen, bro.
well, back in sure, but I'm not bragging on you. I'm just saying.
Right, no, I got you. But and people forget now that the internet didn't just mean the web.
No.
Back in the day, you had the Usenet, which were news groups, and they were basically like the equivalent, closest equivalent would be like a subreddit. So you would go to like for example, because I was this kind of kid, I hung out on alt.gothic, and if you were goth in the 90s and you were on the internet, you went to alt.gothic and you talked about goth music and goth whatever, and hung out with other goths online, and maybe you met up with them in real life, and you know, maybe you hooked up with them. That certainly happened to me. But it wasn't just for that. You know, there was rec music, Grateful Dead, and there were news groups for aficionados of different, you know, Macintoshes, and
I remember just to interrupt because we're partly reminiscing here. My mother, people use the word genius to describe somebody who can hit a baseball further than other people, or can you walk backwards on a stage while singing.
Right.
My mom knew a woman that was married to an actual computer genius, and he got me onto this game called Rogue. I don't know if you know Rogue.
Oh, sure, yeah. Rogue is, in fact... Games that generate themselves every time are still called roguelikes.
Oh, for real. Yeah. So, I was on this... That was kind of the first game that I ever played, computer game that I ever played, that I was like, this is so cool. And he told me, did you know there are these forums you can go on to learn about, to talk to other people about Rogue? And so I did. And man, that was so fun.
Yeah, and at the same time, you also had things like what were called MUDs and MOOs, multi-user dungeons, which were basically like shared text adventures. If you imagine Warcraft, but it's all text, and you can talk to other people, and it's all this shared space, but it's all a text game, you know, set in a whatever, in a dungeon or in a spaceship, whatever it was. So all of these things kind of existed in the early internet in the late 90s and even into the 2000s. And then you had around the turn of the millennium, I would say probably starting in 1998, and all this comes to bear. There's a reason that I'm giving you this kind of history. Is that people invented what were called weblogs or blogs. And so all of us, you know, my first blog software, I literally wrote from scratch with PHP because, you know, Blogger and WordPress didn't even exist yet as software you could download. And so, you know, at first it was just a way to kind of do what people did, or rather what people originally did with, like, Twitter, where you would write out a status. You know, Twitter would ask you, what are you doing right now? And you would say, this is what I'm working on today. Or you would, you know, I'm listening to this music. It's really cool. Short form, but then people started to write longer things, and people started to do group blogs like Boing Boing, which is run by some people that I was acquainted with from my Mondo 2000 days as a writer. Mark Fraunfelder, his wife Carla Sinclair, Zany Jardin joined up, and then eventually Cory Doctorow. And these were just people who would, they would kind of share things that they all found interesting. And so you read Boing Boing because you were interested in the same kind of stuff that these weirdos were interested in. And this, then eventually this thing was created. I want to say it was created by, and I might be wrong, my memory might be amiss here, by a guy named Dave Weiner. Created this thing called RSS, or Real Simple Syndication. So what this meant was that if you read a bunch of blogs, instead of having to go to every blog's web page to read it, you could subscribe to its, quote, RSS feed, which was just the articles from the blog in machine-readable format, and you would have, like, a reader program. And when you opened it, it's the equivalent of, you know, the Apple News app. You would just see headlines from all the blogs you followed. You could organize them into, you know, categories. In the very first part, like maybe the first decade of the new millennium, MP3 blogs were very big. So you would go, and there would be somebody who was just posting new music from unheard bands that they liked. So you'd go every day, and they'd post an MP3 of the day and a review, and it was very cool. That's what Pitchfork kind of started as. And Google had this amazing app that is much missed by many people called Google Reader. It was a free RSS reader. You could just subscribe to not just blogs, but newspapers started to have it. Anything. You could originally, people had RSS feeds for their Instagram. Originally, Twitter, every Twitter user's feed was an RSS feed as well. Or Flickr for photo sharing. Right. And this was all great. This was all really, really useful. And there was an incredible kind of galaxy of people doing interesting things with this, and everybody had a blog, and there were, you know, you started to see the rise of things like Slashdot, which was another group blog for nerds, or the Huffington Post or whatever. And then social media came. And the problem was this. All of this stuff was really great, but nobody could figure out a way to monetize it and create a captive audience. If you use Google Reader, you know, there might be a banner ad at the top, but you were going to all of these different sites. And so people started to create these networks. There was a lot of people think that MySpace was the first social network, but even before that, there was Friendster and TribeNet and a lot of kind of things that have been forgotten since. But you could go and create a profile, and you could very easily, without having to install blog software on a server or know anything about it, you could just go and kind of post stuff and post pictures of your cat or whatever, and other people could follow you, and then you would see their things. And it was like a stripped-down, simplified version of all of this blog, news group, you know, MP3 blogs, all of that. It was kind of a way of putting all of that inside of a walled garden. because nobody could see your post unless you friended them or they followed you or whatever the individual mechanism for that social network was.
So, now, go ahead, but I have a thought.
Well, the reason that all of this actually existed was not to give people a way to post, you know, their favorite My Chemical Romance songs or whatever people were doing. It was a way for these companies, whether it be MySpace or much more egregiously, Twitter, Facebook, what have you, it was a way for these corporations to capture data about you as a user, what you liked, what your favorite music was, what movies you liked, where you went physically, what restaurants you checked into, to create a model, to create what they call a social graph. And this was a way that they could predict things about you and be able to take all of that data and sell it to, at first, marketing companies, but later governments, political campaigns, and in for example, when Facebook first opened the social graph, one of the organizations that started using it was the Revolutionary Guard in Iran to figure out who was gay, which of course was illegal and probably still is in Iran, and round them up. And the reason that these were walled gardens was because Facebook didn't want you going anywhere else but Facebook. And so what originally was just showed you a feed the way that MySpace did, if you remember. MySpace just showed you posts from your friends in chronological order, newest to oldest. And Facebook came up with this thing called the algorithm that dictated what you saw. But what you saw was not was nominally based on your interests, but what it was really based on was figuring out ways to, quote, increase engagement. So they wanted you hooked. They wanted you coming back every 10 minutes to refresh your feed to see new things. And the more that you looked at, they could tell, you know, they had JavaScript built in so they could see how long you looked at any given post or whether you clicked through to read the whole thing or if you commented on it. And all of this built up this kind of psychoeconomic profile of you.
And also, like, Facebook ended up, whether they intended for this to happen or not originally, Facebook ended up causing a lot of problems because, and I think Mark Zuckerberg would have known this had he had more than one friend on the day he created Facebook, right? So let me just give you a real world example, okay, without naming names, right? So the relationship I had with my neighbor across the hall in college was different from the relationship with my aunt, right?
Right.
But when you create a world where my aunt can see, and for a minute there, it was like somebody who knew people in common, people I had in common, could see the posts that I was posting on from other people, right?
Right.
Who they didn't actually know and probably wouldn't have liked.
Right.
And I feel like that created a lot of problems in our society.
Right. Well, because what they were trying to do, again, was to drive engagement. And to a social network person, engagement is a neutral term. Me falling in love with my wife and her falling in love with me on Facebook and us getting together, which is what actually happened, that's a form of engagement. Me telling a Nazi to fuck off is also engagement. It is value neutral to them. Anything.
Right.
So, you know, having arguments, having flame wars, trolling, shitposting, all of these things.
It's easier to get engagement from arguing than it is
exactly.
From, oh, you like this show, I like this show, let's be friends on Facebook for real, or let's be, you know, I get it.
Right, and then they started, the social network started to do kind of dirty tricks to make news organizations rely on them, for example.
Oh, yeah, and then they pulled the plug, and that's where the media really screwed up.
Exactly, and so we've ended up where we are now, which is that There are three or four of these networks. They are owned by people who, even if politics aside, are creepy people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, I'm a left-wing cat, but even if you're right-wing, Mark Zuckerberg and Elon Musk are creepy bastards. And their motives
without talking about explicitly what happened the other day, you know, leaving politics out of it entirely, up until a couple of days ago, I think I might have told you that Zuckerberg was creepier than Musk, but I don't know that I would say that anymore. I don't know that I believe that today.
Exactly. And, you know, and TikTok, everybody loves TikTok, but TikTok may be doing the same thing, but for the Chinese government, as you said.
It might be. I don't know. I've seen good arguments either way, and I'm not privy to the evidence.
But this is the problem. You don't know, and neither do I. The same way that you don't know why certain posts are pushed to you and why they aren't. It's what in computing is called a black box, where it's just a thing. You push a button, something comes out. You can't see how it works. You don't know how it works, and you're not allowed to know.
Well, talking about TikTok, I'll give you an example. All right, I'll give you a real world example. This is not a hypothetical. All right, I can't find anything about the Ukraine war at all unless I expressly search for it.
Yeah. Right,
and even then, I can usually only find like news articles or like news clips. Now, a lot of people on TikTok talk about the LA fires with the same way, but I can actually see people film, this is the LA fire right down the road from me, blah, 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 you know. So
right.
I don't know. I don't know what's happening as far as that.
Right, and the other reason that they started doing the algorithm and the featured, you know, things you may like or whatever, is there's been a lot of talk for the last decade about the idea of what people call bubbles, right? Mm-hmm. I exist in a bubble on social media, and I only see things from people that I, you know, want to see things from, and that's really bad because we're supposed to go out and kind of mingle with and see different points of view. Now, here's the thing. Then, so when I was young, I wrote for this magazine, Mondo 2000, which was a hipper cousin of Wired. It was the punk rock version of Wired.
I remember that, by the way. And there's a part of me that's screaming inside, "Oh my god!"
Yeah, but so because I was involved with this magazine, I became acquainted with a lot of the people who, a lot of the sort of the boomers, the Bay Area boomers, who had been part of the counterculture, and then kind of in the 70s and 80s kind of got into maybe Steve Jobs' orbit, and they became the people driving the internet. One example might be Stuart Brand,
You can correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't one of the literal founding fathers of the internet, didn't he used to be in the Grateful Dead?
Yes, and I'll get to him in a minute. Okay. But Stuart Brand, who I was mentioning, was the guy who created the Whole Earth Catalog back in the 60s, which was kind of like an early version of a group blog, right? And it was super useful and wonderful. And then in the 80s, Stuart created a thing called the Whole Earth Electronic Link, or the WELL, which was one of these dial-up bulletin board systems. And if you went on there, it was full, you know, Jerry Garcia was on the WELL, and all of these kind of Bay Area people, and, you know, Brian Eno and Steve Jobs. And then Stuart and his friend Kevin Kelly, who was kind of involved with this as well, both of them ended up being kind of editors and writers at Wired. And the guy you mentioned, I actually knew him from the time I was 15, 16 years old. His name was John Perry Barlow.
Yeah, that's a guy. Yeah, I remember this now.
Yeah, and so John was a rancher's kid from Wyoming. And in the 60s, he went out to the Bay and he met up with the Grateful Dead, and he never was a member of the band, but he and Robert Hunter were two of their lyricists. So he wrote songs like Cassidy, and I think maybe Box of Rain, although that might be Hunter. I can't remember, but
I'm not into hippie music. I'm more a metal guy. So
right, but so now Barlow made his money, and the interesting thing about John was that he was, up until the Iraq War, John was a Republican.
Huh.
But he was very much on the libertarian side of Republicans, but kind of this. If you remember, you know, there were a lot of boomers like this who were kind of libertarians, but they weren't necessarily leftist libertarians. The kind of, you know, Texas has a lot of these people, you know, shotguns and weed kind of guys. But and what's interesting is that John went on out with his kind of his family's ranch was pretty successful. He had money.
Mm-hmm.
He made more money with the Grateful Dead, but yeah. He and a guy named Mitch Kapoor, who created the Lotus 1-2-3 software suite, which was like the precursor to Microsoft Office back in the 80s. Mm-hmm. So John and Mitch founded a thing called the Electronic Frontier Foundation,
mm-hmm.
or the EFF, which is kind of calls itself the ACLU of cyberspace. Okay. And since the late 80s, I think maybe early, no, I take that back, early 90s, the EFF, mm-hmm. was kind of a nonprofit that was involved with keeping government hands off the internet, keeping freedom of speech on the internet. You know, they fought against the telecommunications or the Communications Decency Act in 1996, and a lot of this came out of this combination of libertarian politics and you know, kind of Bay Area hippie Aquarian politics. For example, the one of the biggest kind of thinkers in the virtual community world, and the guy who coined the term smart mob, is a cat named Howard Rheingold. Mm-hmm. And Howard was one of Ken Kesey's original...
Merry Pranksters, right?
Yeah. He was one of the guys in the bus. He's mentioned in the Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test.
Mm-hmm.
And these were the people who very much architected the early internet. And the thing is, you know, these were people who were in love with Marshall McLuhan and Stafford Beer and all these kind of 60s cybernetic thinkers. And, you know, they all genuinely believed in that, you know, Ted Brautigan had that poem, All Watched Over by Machines of Loving Grace. And so what these people believed, and the thing is, I knew these people. John, I lived in Wyoming in high school, and I cold called him at his ranch one day to see if he could help me get internet in my high school because I knew who he was. We chatted for like 2 hours on the phone, and he passed away a few years ago, but we were, you know, acquaintances from the time I was literally 15 up until he died. But so I knew these people, and I know that their intentions with all of this was based on the theory that if only we can make it so that everyone can communicate with each other, then we'll all understand that we're all the same, that we all love and we all, you know, have the same dreams, and it'll break down, you know, barriers between, you know, political parties and nations and ethnic barriers, and that we would create this kind of, you know, the term that's bandied a lot is cyber utopia. And yeah. The problem is, it's horseshit idea.
The problem is, I'm going to boil it down even further than that. The problem was that Mark Zuckerberg didn't have two friends. The problem is Mark Zuckerberg was creepy. If Mark Zuckerberg had been this normal kid, This is something I will believe until I go to my grave. And you can disagree with me or not, okay? But here's what I'll believe until I go to my grave. If Mark Zuckerberg had been this normal kid who'd been confident around girls, right? Who didn't want to create, who didn't hack into the registry for the people in the different right. houses in Harvard. If he'd have just been some normal dude who
just fell in love with this girl and still been a hacker and still made Facebook. But he had like 10 or 12 friends like everybody used to in college, right? He would have known how to put safeguards, or that safeguards for, I don't want my, you know, this person who I know and that person who I know to interact on Facebook and get into arguments and have that argument spill into the world and blah, 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 blah. Right? He would have had that idea. I'm convinced of it.
I think that's partially it, but I think that there's a larger... There's two larger aspects to this. One is that, remember, Mark didn't invent social media. MySpace was already huge.
But also there was something... There were things before... Okay, this is something that we old heads can argue about forever. But I swear to God, there were things before I even heard the word social media that, looking back on it, was totally social media.
Well, again, like, the Usenet and AOL, like
Yahoo
had...
Yahoo groups. And,
yeah, exactly. Which...
Yeah.
Exactly. But so Mark was kind of extending these ideas that originally came up with these people. And I knew these people, and they were genuinely idealistic, genuinely optimistic, utopian thinkers.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened was you had a combination of these people who basically, and I don't know if they were on the spectrum. I don't want to make that claim. I don't know that that's really is germane to the conversation, but they were basically people who did not understand how human relationships worked. People like Zuckerberg, these are nerds. These are people who are socially awkward, whether it's because of a neurodivergence or if they're just dorks, whatever it is. But the other problem is that when I started to see all of this and started to really understand it in the late 2000s and started to see where this was headed, what I kept thinking about was the Manhattan Project. When the Manhattan Project happened, you basically... Now everybody knows, I've known about this for a long time, but because of Oppenheimer, everybody knows this. The smartest people in the world were all put together to solve a problem. They loved solving the problem. They loved having... I mean, you know, if you were a physicist in the 1940s, Los Alamos was the most incredible meeting of minds maybe that the world has ever seen. And they were solving problems, and they were fascinating problems, and they were advancing their understanding of the fundamental fabric of reality. And it didn't really occur to them that what they were doing was they were making something that would kill millions of people if it could. And,
well, it occurred to some of these people, but not...
Well, bear with me. So,
yeah.
So they all go through, and the bomb happens, and then immediately, many of them, Leo Szilard and a lot of these scientists, including to some extent Oppenheimer himself, started to kind of petition the government to not use the thing that they themselves had just invented for the government. And this goes back to something I see in nerds. And in fact, hilariously enough, one of the best examples of it is a teen comedy from the 80s called Real Genius. You ever see this movie?
No, but go ahead. And
it's one of my favorites when I was a kid. It's basically, it's almost like a Revenge of the Nerds, but it's less sophomoric and more kind of clever. It's basically about these kids who all are at a fictional version of Caltech, and they're geniuses. They're like child prodigies. Mm-hmm. And they're being driven to build this laser by their professor, who's this sort of sleazy version of Carl Sagan with a TV show about science, but he's just kind of a scumbag. And these are kids who have, you know, their whole lives they've been nerds, and they've been laughed at and rejected, and now they're being given all of these tools to do all of this physics research and optics research, and it's amazing to them until the moment that they realize, and there's a character in it who lives in the steam tunnels underneath the college, and he's basically a nutcase. And one of the characters is talking about this, and he says, he was the smartest guy that this school has ever seen, smarter than you and I put together, and he loved solving problems. He loved finding answers to questions. And then one day somebody told him that the answers to the questions that he was creating were killing people. And he went nuts. And this is something that you see again and again in technology, in especially in the 20th century in America, the idea that doing the science or solving the problems is in and of itself a goal for these people, and they're not people who are good at thinking through the ramifications of what solving those problems means. So,
as a history nerd myself, I completely get that.
Sure, you know, so you get these people who are hardcore database and information theory people and network topologists, and they're figuring out, they're going, holy shit, you can quantify human relationships by gathering enough data that basically patterns start to emerge that you can then track, and you can predict human behavior, and you can do all these things. And it's absolutely amazing. And oh my God, I mean, it was so exciting, even for me I'm a coder, but I'm not that kind of nerd myself, but I appreciate it. And so watching it was absolutely amazing. And then they put it out in the world, and the Revolutionary Guard in Iran uses it to murder queers. And they go, well, we didn't anticipate that. It's like, bro, what did you think was going to happen? And the answer is, they didn't think. They didn't think at all. They just wanted to solve problems.
I have a thought. My thought is that real geniuses, like actual geniuses, right, are usually also high-trust people.
Yes.
Okay?
Yes, they are.
High-trust people, right, wrong, good, or bad, can't really, like, it would never occur to a high-trust person that somebody would use that to murder gay people, or somebody would take this algorithm that TikTok invented to show people, to go through their phone and show people what they want to see and use it to show you propaganda or...
Right.
You know...
They're high trust, but they also tend to be socially and culturally sheltered people. They're people right. who they're not exposed to any other kind of, you know, they're people
that's
who are geniuses.
And that's a real problem. That's a real problem in this country.
It is. When I was a kid, I was identified very early as a child prodigy. I learned to read aloud before I was 2.5 years old. And I was studied by like the pediatric psychiatry or neuroscience department at University of North Texas. And my grandparents put me through private schools for most of my childhood, you know, Montessori schools, and I was very much kind of they were grooming me and shaping me to be one of those kids. I didn't have a lot of friends. I wore t-shirts with pictures of Einstein on them or Thomas Edison. I had a bowl cut. I was awkward as shit. I was hyperverbal, as I still am. I talked very fast and spoke in an adult level to other kids who hated me because I was a fucking nerd. And then the best thing in the world that could have possibly happened to me. I discovered rock and roll, sex, and drugs in that order. And I actually ended up, despite this privileged childhood, going to these, you know, kind of high test schools for smart kids and being exposed to all of these kind of, you know, that kind of world, I actually dropped out of high school and got a GED. Because I hated school so badly that I would rather, you know, go and start a punk band than go to school. Mm-hmm. Now, the nice thing about this is that it took me away from STEM, because I could have been one of those kids who everything was science, technology, engineering, and math. And, you know, I started hanging out with, like, the punk kids. So I started reading William Burroughs and, you know, and Bret Easton Ellis or whatever and you know, smoking pot and trying to, you know, bang everything that moved and playing rock and roll. And all of these things taught me not to be that person, those people. You know, once you've had enough, you've hung out with enough Coke dealers, you don't think like Mark Zuckerberg does anymore. And
well, one of the things, going back to what I said before, if Mark Zuckerberg had just been, literally had just had enough friends in his life, or had been confident enough around girls to not to realize that you don't need to hack into Harvard's database.
Right.
You know? And because the other thing, I mean, legally, what he was a, he would have been prohibited from going to college. If he had not made Facebook, he would have been basically prohibited from continuing his education anywhere.
He probably would have been prohibited from moving to a new place without going and meeting all his fucking neighbors.
Well, you got a point. I mean, yeah. I mean, yeah. Sure, you got a point there, buddy.
Now this all goes back to the other component of Kowloon that I think you would find and your listeners would find really interesting.
That was a way back 30 minutes ago or whatever it was. I did have a hypothetical, right? My hypothetical was, let's say I'm a beta user for Kowloon, right?
Right.
And how, if I were to open my Kowloon feed up, what would I be looking at? Like, would I look at...
That's, and so this is where I think, this is to me one of the more clever things I came up with, and the thing I think is going to make this very interesting to people. So... One of the things that I deliberately did with Kowloon is I reintroduced the ambiguity of human relationships.
Oh, tell me what that is.
So, in Kowloon, you don't have... It's not a symmetric friending model like Facebook. Okay. You know, I have sent you a friend request. I am your friend. You are my friend. We will now share everything because that is what friends in human land do. Like, that's always been just creepy as shit, right? Nor does it have the traditional following-follower model, because what that's designed for is to build influencer culture. That's all it is.
So this is not influencer culture.
No, this Kowloon defeats influencers.
Tell me how.
When you create an account, you create what are called circles.
Okay.
A circle is a list of people.
Okay.
It can be, and that list can be public or private. You can choose to make it only you see it, or you can share it. And it can be anybody you want. It can be, you can name it anything you want. So, for example, I can create a circle called Close Friends.
Mm-hmm.
I can put 10 people in it. Nobody sees it but me. I can make my posts visible only to that circle. So I can say, only show these posts to close friends. I can make another one called family. I can, crucially enough, I can make one called family I don't like. Or colleagues who are not friends. Or
aha, so this is how to get away from the relationship I have with my ex-college neighbor. Is different from my relationship with my aunt.
Exactly. Now the thing with Facebook is that there are ways, they've deliberately made it difficult to do this, but there are ways you can kind of set an audience. But this is where circles are more interesting to me. So you can also make a circle called, for example, bands I like. And magazines I read, because going back to the thing we talked about with RSS feeds, when you follow someone in Kowloon, they can be a Kowloon user. It'll also allow you to follow, hopefully very soon after it's going, Mastodon or Blue Sky users. But you can follow RSS feeds natively, built right in.
So let me just ask you a non-hypothetical question.
All right.
As a content creator myself, this is a podcast I'm rebooting. This will probably be the first show on the rebooted podcast. could I give you the RSS feed somehow, and we, you could put that in Kowloon?
Yes, the same way that, that you do it with the successors to Google Reader, like Feedly or Flipboard. These are apps that just kind of picked up where Google Reader took off when Google shut it down. I can go to your podcast, click on a button, the RSS button, and it'll say, do you want to add this to your Kowloon following list?
Get
out. Or do you want to add it to a list, a circle in Kowloon called podcasts?
All right.
So circles can be both input and output. What I mean by that is, is I can make a list that I can set any post to only be shown to people in a circle. But you know how I talked about the different post types in Kowloon?
Mm.
Notes and articles, media, right? Instead of an algorithm, when you open Kowloon, it says you have the choice to see everything from everyone you follow, or you can only see certain, you can choose to only see certain post types, and you can choose to only see posts from certain circles.
I like that already.
So for now imagine this. So let's say that I have a circle called so imagine that I'm my wife and I have I like those TikTok makeup videos, the tutorials that are, you know, a lot of people are really into on TikTok.
Okay.
I can create a circle called, you know, makeup artists or whatever you would call those people.
Mm-hmm.
And I can say, only show me videos or media from makeup tutorial people. And Kowloon has just turned into TikTok for me.
Oh my God, that's so cool. Because this is my problem with TikTok, right? At some point through, I used to use TikTok to just to watch like goofy food videos and dogs and stuff like that. And at some point, TikTok figured out that I was intelligent. And so it started giving me intelligent people TikTok. And that was a real problem. Because now it's like I'm not relaxing.
Right.
You know?
So you could create, like, you know, pet videos as a circle. Now, here's the cool part. You can make that public. So anybody who comes to your Kowloon profile can say, oh, Ben's got this list of dog video creators that are cool. I'm going to take his circle, and I'm going to subscribe to it.
Okay.
So every time he adds a new dog person, or, and this will not probably be in the like beta version, but eventually, you can create collaborative circles that are the equivalent of like Spotify group playlists. So you and me and five other people can all just add whoever we think is cool to this circle and share it with everyone.
So let me walk you through a scenario here, right? So I'm chilling out at the coffee shop or wherever I'm going, right? Doesn't matter. And I've popped open my Kowloon app because I'm a citizen of the 2020s, right? And I can't not look at my phone.
Right.
So I've got my Kowloon open. And what I'm envisioning is like, here's this indie journalist that has their article, right? And then you have this hilarious housewife that has like this little tweet or whatever you call that, right? What, I don't know, right? And then below that, you have this dude with their hilarious ass husky or their, you know, Maltese that's just adorable and funny at the same time. That's kind of what I want, right?
Right.
Is that what you're going for?
Yeah. I mean, so you could create, for example, remember I said that one of the post types are articles, which can be long form.
Yeah.
You can say, okay, these are journalists I follow. Right now, just today while I'm sitting grabbing coffee, I just want to see articles from journalists I like. Or I just want to see notes from family. You know, what is my
Boom.
Family up to? One of the things I liked about the link idea, which seems a little strange to most people, is I love, one of my favorite bloggers is a guy named Jason Kotke, who's been doing it forever. And all he really posts on his site are just links to things he finds interesting. Maybe with a little commentary, you know, but it's like, hey, here's a cool new app I saw, or here's a, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
And so, or Metafilter is the same thing, which is a kind of an online community / group blog that I've been following for 20 years. It's been around forever. And every
Metafilter?
Post is, yeah. And every post will just be like somebody's like, you know, did you know that during the Crimean War this happened? And here's three links to Wikipedia entries and articles about it. So there are times that that's all I want to see. So I can just go and go, oh, these are really interesting people. What links are these people showing right now? Not their posts or their articles or their commentary. I just want to see what they think is interesting. On, you know, what are they sharing from other Kowloon users?
Right.
What links are they showing in the world? Now, here's where this gets very interesting and different, I think.
Okay. Because it's already interesting and different now, but sure.
Right. When you follow someone on Kowloon,
okay,
they don't know that you're following them.
Oh.
No, but I know, but bear with me. Okay. If I follow, like, you and I don't know each other, but I follow you on Kowloon, right?
Okay.
If I'm in a different community, if I'm on a different server, all I see are your public posts, the posts that you have explicitly made public.
Okay.
If we both belong to the same community, I'll see your public posts, and I'll see the things that you've made visible only for the community we both are in. So, which is, you know, it's the equivalent of you know, if I'm on Facebook and you and I both belong to a neighborhood group, I'll see your public posts and I'll see your neighborhood posts, and that's it. Now, you can add me to a circle. You can say, you know, Josh is in my interesting people list, right?
Okay.
When you compose a new post, you add a post, you can say, only show it to interesting people. Now, when I go and follow you, the next time I refresh my feed, I'll see a private
interesting
post.
Interesting people list. Yeah, okay.
But here's the thing. I won't know what circle I'm in. It doesn't tell me, oh, Ben just added me to his cool people circle. All I know is that you've suddenly given me access to something. You've taken me into a circle of trust, but I don't know what circle of trust.
Because
that's the thing. This is how humans, in human relationships, there are things that all of our sort of circles of trust and the things we talk to people about overlap unevenly. So there are things, there are things that I would only share with my close friends and family, like say if I was diagnosed with an illness, right? But there are also things that I would share with family but not close friends, right? Like you know, if Uncle Morty died, or and there's things that I might share with close friends but not family, like this girl I thought was, you know, really cute. We went out, we hooked up. It was terrible. I'll never see her again. Right. We don't want those things to be public. We don't want them to be visible to everybody in our community. We only want them to be visible to certain people we trust. You've never gone to work colleagues and gone, you know what? You're nice enough at work, but I don't really want you to know anything about me in my private life. You don't tell people that. You just do that in your own head. They don't need to know how you've classified them. So in Kowloon, if they follow you, they'll know that they that you've let them into some level of trust, but they don't know exactly what. And that, here's the other cool part. Let's say that you add me to one of your circles, but I don't follow you. I'll never see those posts. They're not pushed to me.
Well, let me throw something out at you here. Now, I'm going to go out on a limb and say, because I'm trying to be on Twitter less. I'm trying to be on Blue Sky more. So I don't see a lot of your Twitter posts anymore. But I'm gonna guess that you don't have children, right? Okay, I don't have kids either, but everybody, all of the Homo sapiens that I know that have children, who are in that circle of friends where we've talked and we've conversed about the daily crap of life, every single person I know that has kids has all said the same thing. When I was a kid, we didn't have the thing, we didn't have the challenges we have now with being online and being a child and meeting full-grown adults, just unvarnished. Let me ask you a hypothetical, right? If I had kids, specifically girls, how would I or could I like make sure there was a kid-friendly Kowloon or like a PG-rated Kowloon, that kind of thing.
Well, okay, so that gets very interesting. Kowloon is open source software.
Okay.
What that means is that I have no control over how people modify it. I have no control over what sort of clients people create for it, because ultimately it's just a data server, right?
Okay.
So if I wanted to, like, let's say, for example, we talked about the idea that if you switch to only seeing media, for example, it would look like TikTok to you, right?
Right.
You could create a Kowloon client app, a mobile app, that only ever showed video and that looked exactly like TikTok. And somebody who used that would never see any of the other stuff and would never know that they weren't looking at a video-only network like TikTok. Mm-hmm. By the same token, you could also very easily, and with my blessing, create a mobile app for Kowloon that had parental controls built in. I have no say over it.
So somebody could, okay, so somebody else, you're saying, be they a concerned parent or an entrepreneur or just a concerned human of Earth, could just say, yeah, I don't want 12-year-old girls to interact with adults unvarnished on the internet. That leads to no good kind of thing, right?
Right, but and now, actually, now that you've asked me that question, there's another facet to this that is a better answer. Okay. So we've talked about how Kowloon begins with a community. Every server is a community.
Sure.
Now, one of the things that's interesting is that as a individual user or as an admin of a community, if I own the community, right, I'm the guy who started the server, I run it, I can block other servers, entire servers. And what that means is that people from those other servers won't be able to contact, reply, react to anything. They can follow public posts from my server because anybody with a web browser can, but they can't interact with anyone on my server. I can also do that as an individual user. So to give you two examples of what that might look like, let's say, because this is open source software, I neither have nor want control over who uses Kowloon once it's launched. Mm-hmm. In the same way that the guys who, you know, started WordPress can't stop a Nazi from using WordPress software on their server to run a Nazi blog, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, the same way that Apple can't stop you from using an iPhone to take child porn pics, or whatever it is, or you know, revenge porn, whatever it is, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I start a server on a Kowloon server that's an LGBTQ activist safe space.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Fair enough. Awesome. Mm-hmm. People there can talk, nobody can see their private conversations. They know, because you can make a community invite only. So they know that everybody who's there is cool. Now, somebody starts a Stormfront fucking SS Kowloon community for Nazis. I can't stop them.
Mm-hmm.
But what I can do is I can say, okay, everybody who's a member of that community is blocked from my server. Can't see them. Can't talk to them. Can't share their stuff. They can't reply to anything on my server. They can't react to it. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, they don't exist.
That's kind of like Reddit did with certain subreddits.
Right, but this is a lot of what I've been doing is taking things that were centralized in these corporate social networks and just kind of releasing it into the wild. But so, to answer your question, the way that you could do that as a parent is you could create a community server that's only for your family. Because you can have five people or 5 million people in a community. It's up to you.
On a Kowloon server, right.
So it's like if back in the day when you would create an email server for your family, you know, so, you know, josh@theellises.com or whatever, then you can go in and the circles that I mentioned, by the way, can be circles of users, RSS feeds, or servers, or any combination of the above. So if I subscribe to a server, if I follow a server rather than a user, a community, I see all the public posts from that community, like if I subscribe to the Huffington Post, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But because circles can be made public, you can also use circles as ban tools, the same way that you can on Blue Sky.
What do you mean ban? Oh, you can say block this list like they do on Blue Sky. Okay.
Right, so I can make a circle called got Nazi it. Assholes.
Got it.
And
got it, got
anybody,
it.
And if I make it public, anybody who wants to can take that and go, you know what, ban all the people on this circle. Mm-hmm. So as a concerned parent, you can go to other concerned parents and create circles called, you know, bad servers or servers that allow people to post whatever. And right. you can just block them. So your kids yeah. will never see them. They can't exist to them.
But okay. But what because, you can't do...
Oh, go ahead.
I guess my question was, right, so you couldn't, for example, I don't know, like, just create a Kowloon server. What am I trying to even say without saying it?
Where you can't see anything except what's inside the server? You mean like a
yeah, building? Like you can't, like, so you have this girl, you have this daughter, and Daddy, I want to be on Kowloon. Okay, boom. But you make it so that the only people that she can interact with are people on that server.
By default, yes. And by default, probably for, like, you know, the initial release, no. But
okay.
If you've ever looked at something like Facebook or Twitter and thought, you know what? What if you could do this with this? This would be really useful if you could do this thing. Because Kowloon is open source, the answer is rock and roll, play jazz, do whatever you want.
Well,
you can. Yeah. I mean, if you're not a programmer, you can't. But if
right.
you,
I'm not talking about the programmers of Earth. I'm talking like the tech savvy mechanic who happens to have a little girl, you know, who he doesn't want to have to deal with, you know, weird creepy dudes talking to 12-year-olds.
Sure. Well, here's a nice thing, though. This is the great thing about open source software.
Yeah.
Whatever problem you have,
someone else has it. Yeah, right. Exactly.
It's somebody who's okay. enough of a nerd to do it. So that's right. the thing is you know, I take Chairman Mao's stance on this. Let 1,000 flowers bloom. And right. so if you want to make a version of Kowloon, the one thing that Kowloon allows you to do that none of the other social networks do is it allows you to go back and create those bubbles, mm-hmm. because bubbles are how human civilization has gotten as far as it has. All of that talk
right.
for the last decade about, oh, you need to get outside of your bubble. No, the fuck you don't. Bubbles are how we stayed sane. bubbles are the reason that we, you know, you didn't know that your next door neighbor what, you know, that the guy who lived across the hall from you in college was a dick, because you weren't forced to know what he was saying,
right?
Right? It's how you or it's like how you know. You know, you can live next to your neighbor right. and not know that your neighbor is a Nazi
another example would be, in real world example would be if you ever go off the garden path on Facebook of your friends and family. And their friends and family, and like the sports team you root for, right? And
you're going to find some.
You're going to find shit. You're going to find some real creepy people.
Exactly.
Very creepy people.
and one of the things that I realized was that there are a lot of people in this world. Many of them work for these social networks, but many of them are just basically plain assholes
mm-hmm.
who believe that my attention is a democracy. That if they want to talk to me, they should have the untrammeled right to talk to me however they want to, about whatever they want, and I should have to proactively tell them to stop. That's not how real humans work. If I'm walking down the street,
we keep dancing around a topic that I hear from teachers all the time now. I hear from teachers and parents all the time now. Which is, there's a whole cohort of children, or maybe even young people at this stage, who act as though they've never had a friend in the world.
Yeah.
And all their friends are through a computer,
And maybe that's what really happened. Like, you right. know what I'm saying? Like,
right. And, yeah. and I hope that this can sort some of that. But I think for me, the larger issue is I realized that I want to talk on the internet and not listen. I want a I want a monologue. Right? When I was a kid, yeah. one of my biggest heroes as a kid was a character that Christian Slater played in a movie called Pump Up the Volume, called Happy Harry Hardon. And it was a kid who had a pirate radio station, and he moved to the suburbs in Arizona, didn't know anybody, didn't have any friends, his family moved him across country. He was awkward, but he could go on his little pirate radio setup that he had built, and he could talk, and he was Lenny Bruce, he was Bill Hicks, he was a genius. And all of these kids in his high school and in the neighborhood and people in the area started listening to him and, you know, listening to what he had to say about how everything was bullshit and how the school was throwing kids out for having bad grades and whatever it was, right? I love talking and I do love listening, but not to everyone. It's like, imagine you're in a bar and you're having a conversation with your friend. And some guy comes up and just goes, well, you know what I think? Well, no, and I don't really give a shit what you think, buddy, because you weren't invited to the conversation. Now fuck off back to the other side of the bar.
And that's not exactly how... That's not the social contract in America, basically, or, you know...
In the world.
People don't... Right.
So every post that you make in Kowloon, no matter what type of post it is, you can choose who can see it, but then you can also choose... who can react to it, who can like or dislike it, and you can choose who can reply to it.
Okay.
Every single one. And it's not, you know, like for example, Twitter has a thing where you can say only people you follow can respond or only people you mention. You can just say nobody can respond to this post at all. Nobody. Not a person can respond. You can't reply to it. I'm talking and I'm not listening. Because I think that that's something that humans need. And we can pretend that the impulse to not allow that is somehow a democratic one or a libertarian one or free
speech.
Whatever,
right.
All it really is they just want to drive engagement. And here, Ben, is the great thing to me about the software, and it's why I think it will be successful. I don't give a shit if anyone on earth but me ever uses it.
Let me ask you a question.
I don't make a dime. If this is something that I want for me and my friends. And if we're the only people who ever use it, awesome. If the rest of y'all want to use it, great. I don't need to drive engagement because I don't care.
Okay, so I guess that was the next set of questions is what's the plan to put it out there? Do you put it in the Play Store, App Store?
Well, yeah. So how
do we do that?
There's two components. There's a server, which just lives on an internet server somewhere, which has a web interface, and you can use Kowloon purely with that, with the web, without any apps. You don't need an app to use it. Mm-hmm. But we're also going to have, of course, an Android and an iOS app for it. but do you remember when anybody could write a Twitter app? There was like TweetDeck, and there were all these kind of useful ones.
Yeah, somebody killed that. Mm-hmm.
Yes, they sure. did. And Kowloon is built so that you can't kill that. So if you can make a better Kowloon client than me, the guy who created Kowloon, if you can write a better mobile app for it, rock and roll, man. You want to charge for it? Cool. Most people will probably use the free version that I create. But if you want to charge, go right ahead. If you want to take Kowloon and modify it so that you can do data mining and ads and all of that evil shit, cool. But I think most people will use the official version that doesn't allow that.
I wonder, from the inside looking out of that, I wonder if fewer and fewer people are actually using the internet. Like the way they used to use the internet, I wonder
and
if
that's,
what people...
That's what I'm trying to bring back. That's what
you know.
I think
what people? It's like people watch TV on the internet now, and people. But I don't think there's a lot of communication.
Right. Well, and that's the thing. I mean, I can't. It's like being an author in 2025. I can't make people read the way they did in 1975, when every construction worker was walking around with a copy of Jonathan Livingston's Seagull, and every dental hygienist had a copy of Love Story by Eric Segal. I can't make people read. I can only write books.
You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube, basically.
Right. But think about this. Think about... I'll let you in a little secret. I pirate media a mm-hmm. lot. Mm-hmm. And on my home server are... I have like 1,000 movies that I've downloaded.
Mm-hmm.
And I would guess that probably 80% of those are not available on streaming.
Oh, yeah.
I've got movies that were never actually officially released on DVD. I've got movies that have, like, the Sundance Channel logo because somebody taped it off of Sundance onto a digital capture in 1999 and put it out on BitTorrent or Napster, whatever it is, right?
Years ago now, I listened to a podcast. I think it was the Script Notes podcast when I used to listen to that. And they talked about how there's a lot of movies out here that are depressingly new. There's a lot of really new movies who never made it to streaming because people died. Or the company that held the rights went away and nobody acquired the rights.
Or one that happens a lot is they couldn't get the rights to the music used in the movie or the TV show for streaming. That's why, for example, Northern Exposure wasn't available on streaming for decades, because they couldn't mm-hmm. get the usage rights for all the pop music in it. But here's the thing. So everybody complains about how nobody watches anything but superhero movies, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm one of those people.
Right. And so, but if the only thing you have on streaming is superhero movies and Netflix's latest, Chris Pratt, Dwayne The Rock Johnson horse shit, mm-hmm. then... Of course, no. People aren't going to be watching David Lynch movies, So
I mean, what I've noticed, frankly, is like there's a, I don't want to say dumbing down, but I feel like it strikes me that there's an age that you get to where, like, okay, the way I say it is like this: the Christopher Nolan Batman were interesting. Because it was Batman in the, quote, real world.
Right? Or closer to it, sure. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But by the time you get to now, and it's like, but we've seen that. We've seen Batman in the real world. Can we?
Right. Well, no, because of course, what happens is that one person does something brilliant, and every unbrilliant bastard in the world decides they want to climb on the coattails and make a little money off it.
And I think even Christopher Nolan said that.
Sure. The thing is that I remember, and it might be a rose-tinted version, but I remember an internet where people didn't just go on to talk shit at each other, and people could choose who they saw and choose where they wanted to go and who could talk to them and who they wanted to talk to. And they could create, communities that were, to use the current terminology, safe spaces, because that's important. That's important for mm-hmm. everybody. It's important for little, non-binary kids. And it's important for dudes who just want to talk about fucking Ford pickup trucks. That's all they want to do. They don't want to talk about politics. They don't want to have to deal with stuff that they're not culturally ready for. And you know what?
And they also don't want to see everything on their phone be an ad for a Ford pickup truck.
Exactly. Right. And you know what? If some 60-year-old dude doesn't want to see, people standing up for their right to be furries, you know what? I may think that sucks, and I may think he needs to be open-minded, and that's the thing that he needs to learn about, but that's not my choice. That's his choice. Mm-hmm. So if all he wants to do is talk to his 5 poker buddies about Merle Haggard, cool.
I think the internet, now assumes that you're 30 years old with a master's degree, and you live in a very liberal city, and you yourself are more liberal than your parents.
I think that's what the internet assumes people are, and well, that's not what the internet is.
No, it's and I think that the honest truth is that I am pretty far left, right? I have the word anti-fascist tattooed on my chest, okay. Right? Like I read Kropotkin, I read Bakunin, the anarchist. You know, I'm not necessarily a full bore. Like I'm not a tanky. I'm not like a Maoist or Leninist. But I'm a democratic socialist. I'm in Bernie Sanders, Jeremy Corbyn territory, right? And there are still people who identify as being on the left who irritate the living fuck out of me. I don't ever want to be at a party with them. I don't want to have to talk to them. I don't want to have to listen to them. Even if now here's the thing, Ben. Even if I agree with them politically, even if I'm like absolutely, which I am, absolutely, we should have trans rights for everybody. I think it's awesome. It's great. I'm all for it. I am an ally. I will back you. I don't care that much. Like I care about your rights, but I don't care about your personal experience. It just doesn't interest me. No offense. But most people's, I don't care about the life of an ice road trucker either. I don't watch those shows. If you came to me and said, you need to care about ice road truckers, I'd be like, fuck off. I just don't.
Yeah.
And so we need to give people the space to not give a shit about other people's experiences.
The problem, I think, is that we started using politics as a way to meet people. And that's just not good. That's not good. That's not healthy. You know, I hear all the time these people younger than us say that we don't have any third spaces. The reason they say that is because they don't, like, we don't have a mall anymore. But also, like, one thing the internet did was it made it so that I can watch a movie in my bedroom. Like, I can watch a movie on Amazon in my bedroom instead of going to the theater with a buddy of mine and watching a movie and then going to the diner afterwards. I mean,
that's
the problem.
Right. Like, I don't discover music by going down to my local record shop with the two scruffy Jack Black, John Cusack-looking motherfuckers and go, guys, what's cool this week? Because I know that they know what's cool. Not what's... But what's cool. So I'd go and buy my, two CDs. Then I would go to my local coffee shop where everybody behind the counter knew me. They'd make my drink when I came in. I could go and sit for hours, listen to the CDs I'd bought or read the books I'd bought, the used bookstore from the clerk I like. Everything has been turned back towards commerce. Everything has been turned back towards transaction.
Well, what happened... I say this a lot, and I'm a trained social historian, and what social historians talk about is there's this little thing that happened in society that actually ended up being huge, right? And here's the thing that happened. The malls closed. They went away, and they died. And also at the same time, and I clocked this decades ago. At the same time, computer games became very engrossing.
Yep.
So these two things sort of converged, and I was back in college at the time, and I was saying, you've got these kids that they've never met friends, they've never made friends, and now you're putting them in the world, and the only thing they can talk to somebody about is politics, because it's the only common interest they have.
Well, but also I think one of the things about the internet that's different in the social media era is that there are no differentiated spaces. So
yes,
when I was young, we had different cafes, right? Coffee shops. You know, you think of the kind of the 90s stereotype. But the funny thing is, each coffee shop had a crowd and a culture,
had a vibe.
So, if you were in Las Vegas at the turn of the millennium and you were somebody who hung out in coffee shops, you were either a Cafe Romo kid, a Copio kid, or an Enigma Cafe kid. And people went to all three of them, you know, it kind of went around, but you were one of those because that was your community. And it was different than the community of the cafe that might be across the street. when I was living in L.A. in the 90s, there was a great cafe called Nova Express that was on Fairfax near Hollywood. And right across the street from it was the famous Cantor's Deli, which was also like a hangout spot.
Oh, so yeah. Even I've heard of Cantor's, and I've lived thousands of miles from it.
Yeah, and so this was during that whole swingers thing, right?
Yeah.
So Cantor's was where all of the kind of swing, ska, go daddy go, zoot suit riot hipsters hung out. And then Nova Express was like where the goths and the punks and the freaks hung out. They were across the street from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And you were either a Cantor's person or a Nova Express person. And, you know, yeah, you'd go to one or the other sometimes. You know, I'd go to Cantor's for a Reuben, but I was a Nova Express kid. So one of the things that I wanted to do with Kowloon was to create again the idea of these bounded, finite communities. Because going on Twitter or going on Facebook is like going to a bar, except everybody in the world is in the bar.
Everybody
in the world. And they can all hear your conversations.
And now the owner of the bar is trying to renovate said bar. Go ahead.
He's putting up swastikas on the fucking walls. And the thing is, there is nowhere, but that is the one bar. That is the only bar now.
I mean, somebody else, the owner of the previous owner of said bar made another bar, but it's not as big. And you have somebody that I follow on Blue Sky said it perfectly. Blue Sky is people who talk about being on Blue Sky.
Right.
Right.
Sure. But in the same way that there have always been bars that people go to talk about how cool they are for hanging out at that bar, right?
Right.
So what Kowloon is meant to do is to allow anybody to open a bar or cafe.
Right.
All you have to do is either have a server, or the goal is to make it as simple to set up as a blog. But when you create a community in Kowloon, you are the HNIC. You're the head nerd in charge, right? What you say goes. The same as if you start a cafe. When I was young, one of the perks of working at or owning a cafe was you got to pick the fucking music, right? Mm-hmm. I dreamed of owning a cafe where I could just play Tom Waits all day at everybody, right? So this is the same thing. If you want to make your own community that, you know, is run the way that you want it to be, and it's bohemian, it's funky, and you don't, you know, you make sure that if somebody says something that's edgy, but not too edgy, you know, Kevin Smith edgy, not Nazi edgy, that they don't get called out for their shit, because everybody knows that everybody's basically cool, right? Some people just have a weirder sense of humor, but everybody knows that everybody who's in the community is all kind of care about each other, and it's a real community, right? And then if you want to make a community with blackjack and hookers, great. Go do that. But I also want to make it so that the people who are hanging out in the funky little bohemian place don't have to deal with the SS Waffen assholes next door coming into the cafe and stomping all over everything, which is what all of social media is now. And it's encouraged because the more that people are doing anything, including fighting, swatting each other, she's sending dick pics.
The more they can see the t-shirt ads, or not t-shirt ads, but like the ads for outboard motors and stuff.
And the more data can be mined from them, and the more tracking cookies can be added, so they can sell that to whoever, to fascists or to marketers. And I just want to have done with that. I want an alternative, and I'm hoping that might help people remember what human socialization.
It's really sad when you hear 15-year-olds say they've learned what a third space is for the first time, and they say, "We don't have those anymore." And you're like, "Yes, we do." And then they run down the road. Then they run down what doesn't exist anymore. And you're like, "Oh shit, the kid's right. Nobody goes to Target. Like, nobody hangs out at Target."
Right, exactly. You know, and there are certain bells. There are bells that you cannot unring. We are not going to put this genie of the internet back in the bottle, but what if we So, and that's all that Kowloon was it was me going, okay, what would a social network look like if you didn't give a shit if it made money and it was made to do what people want it to do, which is to communicate with each other?
Thank you so much. And tell everybody the name of your, the wacky name of your app again, because I'm going to butcher the name.
It's Kowloon. It's K-O-W-L-O-O-N. It's named after a section of Hong Kong that used to be called the Walled City, that was kind of a community unto itself. There was no law there. The cops wouldn't go in. It existed as this kind of temporary autonomous zone for decades in Hong Kong. And in one of my favorite writers is the cyberpunk writer William Gibson. Mm-hmm. And in his novel Idoru, he has these hackers who create a virtual place that's a recreation of the old Walled City, which was actually torn down in Hong Kong in 1994, I think it was. Uh-huh. And so these characters are talking about this virtual Kowloon, this virtual Walled City that only exists in virtual reality. And he says, one of the characters says, it started as a kill file turned inside out. And a kill file was the William, old...
Is this William Gibson?
Yeah. Yeah. A kill file in sort of ancient internet parlance was, it was your block list for email. If you had a kill file, it was just a text file on your server with a list of emails. And if anybody who had one of those emails tried to email you, it wouldn't go through. It's like a spam or a block filter, right? And the character says, it's like a kill file turned inside out. Which is gibberish. Like, it, technologically speaking, it is a nonsense sentence. But I was rereading Idoru like 5 years ago, and I started to think, what would that actually look like? And that's what led to what I'm in, you know, we're very close. I've got the server is mostly built. I've been getting volunteers who are going to help me get it to the point where it can be beta tested. Hopefully within the next few months that'll happen. But all of that just came from kind of taking this idea that William Gibson had, this nonsense sentence that still sounds cool, and going, okay, well, how would you do that? And then everything I've learned in like almost 40 years of being online. So that's it.
Hey man, thanks a bunch. And, just hang on with me for a second while I download this sucker.
All right.